You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello everybody and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. With a federal poll looming later this year, all sides of politics are ramping up the rhetoric to fever pitch, but with a slightly different edge. This year, more than ever, new technology is being used to communicate to the constituents. There seems to be a definitive swing away from the traditional and mainstream media channels to get the political message out there. Facebook and YouTube are certainly new tools in the political marketing machine's arsenal, but in an effort to bring the latest political trends and swings to the desktop, this week sees the search juggernaut Google launch a new service for the Australian voters. Last week, Google launched an election website that will enable voters to access video footage, user-generated content, and customised information feeds as it and other key publishers gear up for what will be Australia's first YouTube election campaign. That's right, you heard it correctly, Australia's first YouTube election campaign. If you're a user of iGoogle, a customizable desktop allowing the display of user-chosen information, you'll be familiar with the use of tabs for different topics. With the click of your mouse on the google.com/election2007 website, a new tab will be installed which displays the latest YouTube videos from each political party, the latest news from your electorate, user-configurable election trends, even a selection called Australian MPs on the record, where Google returns the documents containing the name of the MP and the selected issue. Is this a sign of the times or what? It seems that Australian voters are indeed connected. You can even add special Australian election content to Google Maps. Why not find your electorate and see your seat in satellite view, explore marginal seats and view candidates? But wait, there's more.
Welcome to Google's Australia Votes channel. This is where you can have your say and join in discussions on the upcoming federal election.
If you become a subscriber to the Australia Votes channel, you'll be notified of the latest videos uploaded.
If you want to have your say on the Australian federal election, there are two ways.
First, you can click Post a Video Response below any video on the Australia Votes channel. Then, upload your video and it will appear as a video response. Second, you can click Post a Text Comment under any video on the Australia Votes channel. Your comment will then appear under the video in question.
So go on, get involved and have your say this election with Google's Australia Votes channel.
So as we head for the local polling booth in the next few weeks, it seems that Google has just about thought of everything, except for one small minor detail. We need a chaser gadget for when we need that well-earned break from reality.
And we're climbing a stairway to Canada.
This week on Tech Talk Radio,
we take a look at iTunes success. Telstra sets the watchdog on Koonin, Sony ramps up the high-definition challenge, winemakers embrace open source, and Google funds a $30 million moonshot. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the tech world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Telstra's CEO makes bold claims about Next G, Apple and AT&T in damage control after the iPhone is successfully hacked, Australia's new TiVo won't skip advertisements, Whirlpool sued for negative forum postings, and legal threats spell the end for Melbourne swap meets. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Telstra's Chief Executive Officer, Sol Trujillo, has claimed his company's mobile broadband network is the fastest in the world, angering regulators and confusing industry analysts. In an interview on CNBC television in the United States, Mr. Trujillo said that Telstra's new Next G network was the fastest mobile broadband network in the world. Telecommunications industry analyst Paul Buddha spoke on Melbourne Radio last week about Mr. Trujillo's claims.
I think that's a very difficult claim to make. There's no doubt that Telstra has a very sophisticated network. It's one of the biggest in the world. The size of the country, of course, dictates that. But it's a standardized technology. You know, this technology is used throughout the world. It's standardized, and therefore, other countries have who are building these networks can generate similar speeds and are generating similar speeds. So it's a bit of a bold claim to say that you are the fastest if it's a standardised technology.
According to the ABC, Mr. Trujillo's interview is being pored over by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, who are examining his claims about Telstra's mobile broadband capacity. The CEO's comments were made only weeks after a controversial series of commercials was withdrawn from Australian television at the request of the ACCC after complaints were received that the advertisements were misleading. A software patch has been devised which allows Apple's iPhone to be used on any GSM network. According to IT Wire, the patch takes only a few minutes to flash the firmware in existing iPhones, freeing subscribers from US carrier AT&T. Previous iPhone hacks had been published on the internet which required hardware modifications with the use of a soldering iron. This latest patch from website iPhoneSimFree.com only requires a one-click graphical user interface to free the iPhone from AT&T. The crack has not yet been made public, but internet heavyweights like Engadget and news service IT Wire have verified the claims and even released videos of hacked devices. Neither Apple nor AT&T have commented on the patch, and it's unknown at this stage if the software will legally be available in the short term. Engine has confirmed that next year's TiVo personal video recorder will have twin high-definition tuners, but won't be able to skip recorded advertisements. The distributor said the Australian unit will be based on the TiVo HD recorder released in the United States in July and will also feature an HDMI port and 1080i output. But the Australian model won't be equipped with the ad-skipping features found in the US TiVo. Mr. Phil Dobby, Chief Marketing Officer of Engine, said last week Australians will be able to fast-forward through ads but not totally skip. It will be a fast scan. You should be able to get through an ad break in 30 seconds. Mr. Dobby also confirmed that the Australian TiVo will offer wireless connectivity via USB Wi-Fi adapters, as well as Ethernet for downloading the electronic program guide announced by Free TV Australia earlier this year. While the US version features a 160GB hard drive, Engine was still unable to confirm the capacity of the proposed Australian model. Popular Australian broadband discussion forum Whirlpool is at the centre of a legal wrangle over comments posted by users on its web-based bulletin board. According to a statement of claim filed in the Queensland Supreme Court last week, software company 2Clix is alleging injurious falsehood against Whirlpool's owner after the forum refused to remove user comments that criticised 2Clix software products. A 2Clix spokesman said there is a legal process underway and on our legal advice we will be making no comment. Founder of Whirlpool, Simon Wright, says the legal action affects all online discussion forums and even film reviews. In particular, the action raises concerns over the legal liability of administrators of bulletin boards and forums and public blogs when it comes to users' postings. And Melbourne computer enthusiasts making the Sunday morning pilgrimage to the famous ComTrader computer swap meets will need to find a new source for their weekly technology fix. Max and Dorothea Morton, the owners of Technology Supermarkets Proprietary Limited, have decided to stop running the immensely popular swap meets after receiving threats of legal action from lawyers in relation to the sale of counterfeit goods at the swap meets. A posting on the popular internet forum Whirlpool said that the organisers have found the allegations and threats of legal action to be very stressful and detrimental to their health and have reluctantly decided to stop running the swap meets. The weekly swap meets, attracting thousands of enthusiasts every Sunday morning, had become an institution in Melbourne, and Max and Dorothea Morton thanked their staff and customers for their support over the past 16 years. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Last time we had Patch Tuesday, my servers restarted themselves. It was not a pleasant sight. Windows 2000 was all that pre-genuine stuff, wasn't it?
And there was going to be an update come out in this batch of updates, but Microsoft have pulled it.
Why?
Well, they're not saying why.
We take it for granted in Australia that you just turn a radio on and you can hear it. You turn television on, you can see it.
Even the thought of having to pay for something like that would have people laughing in the streets.
While we're on the subject of iPhones,
like radio in the US is all volunteer-based, so that they only have the subscribers that they can sign up.
I this and I that, I DVD, I do your dishes, I do this.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Whatever happened to the unlimited plans? I think they all became untenable for the ISPs, didn't they?
Because of the few bandwidth fogs that downloaded everything under the sun. So this is like Australia's funniest YouTube clips or something.
Yes. I could only imagine, really. With commercial television programmers
battling... I feel so sorry for Tony Parent.
I don't.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Showtime.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And a very good evening. Welcome, everybody, to the superlative show called Tech Talk Radio. Welcome aboard, wherever you might be listening to us from, one end of the country to the other end. Bit of a panel this evening. It's good. Graham and I held the ship afloat. I kept the ship afloat last week, but Dr. Ron joins us with his dulcet tones this week. Good evening, Dr. Ron.
Hello there. Here are my dulcet tones. That's it's good to be back this week.
Did you miss us? We missed you.
I really did. It's always I have withdrawal symptoms. I was getting all excited tonight. I think I get to do Tech Talk tonight. That's great.
Yeah, when did you listen to the podcast?
Probably on the Wednesday, I think.
Yeah.
I finally got around to it.
Yeah, very good.
It was an entertaining show.
Yeah, no, we were. Mark was going to come in last week, but he got hit by the flu, and I think I'm still a bit sniffly tonight, so if I die in the corner, it's all yours, boys. Graham's here too. He's just plugging himself in because, as per normal, Graham's just left everything to last minute, but that's good.
What did you say? But he's early for next week's show, is
yeah,
that
I
right?
Did, I yeah, said that. Yeah, he's just plugging in as we speak.
It's always a good way to look at these things.
What a week in tech it's been.
It's been incredibly busy.
It's been, you just get these things, you go from one extreme to the other in technology, and the week before, quiet week, you know, this week... Oh, goodness me, we couldn't... There's so much to talk about, so we either have to speak quickly this evening or, I guess, yes, skip a few things as we normally do. We try our very best. Hey, if you're listening to us on the one-hour show, try downloading the podcast because there's going to be so much wall-to-wall gossip in that, unfortunately. We can't squeeze it all into one hour, so be sure to visit the website, techtalkradio.com.au.
And hey, extra specially big hello to our new listeners on Highlands FM and also Huon FM.
Huon, yeah, in Tassie.
That's it. And if you don't know, because you may not have heard before, this won't be the first time you're listening to the show, forum.techtalkradio.com.au is the internet discussion forum for all things related to the program.
And if you say something there, we'll be sued. So please be careful. We'll talk about that, two clicks, later on in the show.
We will.
I think Graham's ready to push his photo up. Good evening, Graham. How are you?
Good evening, Andrew. Good evening, Dr. Ron.
Hello, yes. Graham. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Yes. Any news? You got lots of letters and things like that, haven't you, Dr. Ron?
I do. Speaking of the forum, a big hello to the new people that have signed up in the last few weeks. SMI Phones... Mali, Sasa,
that's a worm, isn't it?
Maybe a worm signed up. Checker in South Australia, hello. Kozak and the Tech Girl have all signed up in recent weeks. So very big welcome to those forum users.
Very good. Any mail?
No, not a lot of mail this week. Although we had the usual contributions from our valued contributors like GD and TARDIS 3, and those people will be talking about their news items later on.
We will indeed. Jonathan gave us a ring earlier on in the course of the week.
Hi, Jonathan.
eBay. Anyone had problems with eBay? There's a few, you know, scrupulous or unscrupulous traders out there that say they send things and then don't. And Jonathan was the... unfortunately, copped the raw end of the stick, but he rang eBay trying to... Well, hang on. Let me not tell the story. I'll let Jonathan tell the story.
Hi, I'm Jonathan. I regularly use eBay and PayPal and thought I was well protected from fraud. All the advertisements lead you to believe that. However, one thing I bought didn't arrive. I paid for it by PayPal. So I contacted eBay and PayPal, and their result of the investigation was that, yes, the seller is dodgy. You are protected. If we manage to get any money off him, we'll give it back to you. That's not quite what I expected. I thought there would be much more of a insurance type policy than that, because the seller is in an Asian country and I don't think they'll have much chance of getting any money off him.
I wonder how many, you know how on eBay you get those little things about how good the sellers are, the honesty reports, I guess you call
feedback,
them?
Feedback reports and things like that.
I wonder if that seller had anything up there or not, or whether he was a new seller. I'd always be very dubious, especially from countries which aren't in Australia. Of
how many countries
new sellers.
Are in Australia?
Well, you know what I mean, apart from Tasmania and Queensland.
Just testing.
Yes,
there are a couple, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. There are a few we have here. But, anything outside Australia I'd be fairly dubious about.
Mm. It's also a good idea to have a look at the value of the item that you're buying, I think. If it's something that's going to be worth $15 or $25 and you think, well, if I blow my money, it's not going to bankrupt me. But if you're spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on eBay, like I have in the past, I've bought things worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars, you need to have a look at the feedback.
Yeah, definitely.
Of the person you're buying from.
Definitely. But I think Jonathan's sort of gripe is in relation to the policies.
Yeah, the protection that's afforded.
We all seem to think we have this security blanket thrown over us by PayPal, which is eBay's online transaction business. Because I think eBay bought
them.
And
they do say they have buyer protection. And
they do.
All of that sort of stuff. If you pay by PayPal, you've got up to however many $1,000 protection.
Exactly. And there's a few, I know this has been talked about in the mainstream media too, that it's not all that it's cracked up to be. I think I've heard the guys out of Sydney, eBay and Sydney, talk about it. And, of course, they just pedal their own wagons a little bit, pedal their own bikes. And, I don't know. But buy beware. It's like anything, really, whether you go into a shop, a bank or whatever, I'd be out there having a bit of a look. Because I know on a credit card, I'd be probably going back through the banking system, because as a merchant, if you buy something and it gets debited to your credit card and it doesn't come through forthwith, I'd be inclined to go back to your bank and say, hang on a minute, I bought this through PayPal, it didn't arrive, can you reverse it please?
What's
or put
going
in a
on? Yeah.
Contest the chargeback.
Yes,
that's all right. And then PayPal will go, well, you know, it's this $40 charge, but they probably get them all the time. But I'd say I'd go down that path, to be quite honest, as a merchant.
It's an interesting one. Yeah, I'm in the middle of a dispute with over an eBay item as well at the minute, which it looks like it may have been an item that went missing in the post. So I'm not convinced that the seller's dodgy.
It's always a tricky one.
In fact, he's been fairly upfront in his communication, but the item never arrived.
Mm.
So,
Was it? From Australia?
Yeah, it was from Queensland.
The country? Oh, that country.
That country, yep. It was another country within Australia. It was from Queensland.
Wasn't Ben May, was it?
No, it wasn't Ben May.
Oh, hi, Ben.
No, it was a bloke by the name of Owen. Cheers, Owen, if you're listening. And, so I may have a story to tell at some point in the future as well. I won't say too much about what's going on while we're still trying to resolve it, but...
When I've sold things in the past that have been of a significant value, I've often taken photos of the item, and then I've taken a couple of photos of the item packaged and addressed sitting on the table. So at least I can say, well, look, here was the thing, this is the condition it was in before I sent it. I did actually package it, I've put postage on it, I've addressed it to the buyer, and you know, just for the sake of taking a couple of quick digital
my
snaps.
Tips, always send it registered mail.
Yes, I was about
it's
to mention
it's an extra $2 or $10 or whatever it is.
But I've had problems with the one I missed. That's the step I missed. I asked the seller how much his postage is going to be. He told me, and I sent it, and I didn't ask whether it was registered or not.
Yeah, no, registered mail's good because you got the trial. You forget about yellow bags.
Yep.
Australia Post and yellow bags, that's just another planet.
But
those guys.
Well, you're right, Andrew. I'm a bit sceptical about registered mail as well, because I've sent stuff registered mail before and it goes missing. And what you're saying is correct.
But at least then you've got a claim back against Australia Post.
Well, it's $5
in your bag if you
send
it on Yellow Post.
Good luck with that. Australia Post say, yes, you did register the article with us, and oh yeah, we can see exactly where it's gone missing. And you go, well, thanks very much. That's very helpful. And that's as far as you get with Australia Post. So I'm a bit sceptical about
spending.
Yes, I must
admit, I haven't done very well with getting answers out of Australia Post either. But
no, just
never had a problem with them, but I don't send things in yellow bags.
Well, putting the cynical hat on, it's just a way for them to get a bit more money out of their customers.
I did get very cranky with one of their telephone operators during one of the phone calls, and I did ask if they could send me out the application forms to become a postal delivery person, because obviously there's a significant business to be made on the side, selling
a great deal of latitude in terms of your work performance.
Yes.
I think Adam's had issues with Australia Post too. It might have been Adam. It might have been somebody else. Mm. Where those goods and services, you know, those special demo things arrive, but they never arrive.
Well, eBay bought PayPal. Maybe they could buy Australia Post next.
eBay, yes, there you go.
There's an idea for anyone listening in eBay management. That's what we need.
Fantastic.
Or set up a competitive postal network in the country.
Right, we should move on. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au is our email address. We're monitoring that right now. Feel free to send us a email because we like getting your emails. GD has. He's listening to us this evening. Hello, GD. You boys big on iTunes?
I'm big on iTunes from the point of view that it's a good catalogue or library program for all of my music.
Well, yeah. We talked about this last week briefly. Haven't you?
No, I have used it. I don't use it.
We know about your thoughts of buying compressed music.
Mm.
Have you bought any of the new stuff? Graham, have you bought any of the new copy protection free?
No, haven't been down that track.
I must do one just so that I can say that I've done it.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, they've upped the bit rate or something like that, so better quality doesn't quite sound so watery.
Mm.
But, yeah, Steve Jobs, when he was really talking up the iTunes success the other day, here's a quick snip of what he had to say.
We have distributed over 600 million copies of iTunes so far. 600 million copies. And customers have bought and downloaded over 3 billion songs from iTunes. And iTunes is the number one online music store in every single one of the 21 countries that it operates in. Now, we started with just 200,000 songs, but we have over 6 million songs in every single one of those stores in the 22 countries. So not just in aggregate, but in every single store, we have over 6 million songs.
That's a lot of songs to have in your iTunes. I've got 100,000 library tracks, and it really works hard. I'd hate to think how 6 million went, let me tell you. But that's a phenomenal number when you think about iTunes and where it's come from and where it's going to.
600 million copies of iTunes. Would that include all the upgrades? Like,
now, there's a thought.
There is a new version of iTunes available. Yep. Yeah, there's another 100 million.
Yet again, yep. And how many people downloaded it, tried it once, thought, oh, no, and uninstalled it. Do they count all those as well, obviously?
Well, I had to, in the spirit of Tech Talk Radio, I decided to actually go to 7.0.4 point something the other day because it had ringtones in it. I thought, oh, this would be interesting, but they haven't turned it on yet. Not in this country anyway.
Right.
Maybe they haven't done the deal yet. Did you hear about the ringtones that you can now buy on iTunes?
I was listening last week to the program.
Well, you were. That was a trick question. You were listening. I'm impressed.
Yes.
I thought I might try that, but no, still no luck yet at this point in time. So
we're a bitter and twisted and cynical bunch in here at times, aren't we?
Speak for yourself.
Always speak for myself.
So, and a well done iTunes. I think that's quite good. But there are others out there too. A lot of online stores. You know, JB Hi-Fi, Australian company, getting into all this sort of stuff. Harvey Norman's. But I think iTunes have got the head start. And also they've got the iPod. Have you bought an iPod recently?
No.
No. Okay. We'll move on, shall we?
Yes.
Get a red one if you do buy one. That's all I'd say to you.
I saw, last week you were talking about the facelift. They've had the new cases on
Yeah, they've
on
gone
them.
Beige. If you think of the bright, vivid colours that they used to have, there are about half a dozen colours in the range. They've actually toned them down now to pastels. They're going through their feminine phase.
They're very nice looking in. I had a really good look at the iPod range after last week's show. I should have looked at it before, of course. But, they're looking quite nice. The iPod Nano looks like quite a good little unit these days.
I'd buy one of those. $79. Just even if it...
No, that's the Shuffle.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Which is the next one up?
The Nano is the next one up. It's okay. The smaller one. It's got the 2-inch screen.
Oh, that's the new video one he was talking about.
And
Steve,
it's like $270 for
the most dense pixels you'll get on any portable device. 204 PPI.
And I think it's 8 GB. It's flash memory. It's really small. It's really light.
You going to buy one? You normally have gadgets in here.
I'm seriously thinking about it.
Ooh. Have you got an MP3 player now?
No, that's why I'm seriously thinking about it.
I have decided
I need an MP3 player.
Yeah.
But, that iPod Nano is looking quite good.
I'm waiting for the Sony B100. We had it as a gadget of the week a couple of weeks back. They look really quite good.
Yeah.
Because I like the mini disc technology, but then they went MP3 and compressed and all sound watery. But hopefully this new new box is going to be quite good.
There'll be some people who aren't sad to see the end of A-Track, though.
Which well, no.
The Sony compression that wasn't compatible with anything, but sounded really good.
Oh, well, watch your space.
You'll have Sonic Stage to look forward to, or Disc to Phone, or another piece of proprietary software.
And it'll play slowly for you.
Pointless. Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Telstra.
I'm very bitter and twisted tonight, aren't I?
You are. You're just venting.
I am.
You haven't been in for a week, so you're getting out of your system.
That's what it is.
You've been keeping it bottled up.
Check your Medicare card at the door on the way out, please, Dr. Ron.
A fortnight of frustration. Mm. Is what happens, you see.
Telstra have been in the news for absolutely everything under the sun this week. And we shouldn't really dwell on any one particular thing in particular, but the one beautiful Polly Farmer, he's a footballer, legendary footballer, was really good at handballing. The brilliant Polly Farmer Award this week goes to the Honourable Senator Helen Coonan, who has decided to give Mr. Ruddock, the Attorney General, the pure power of vetoing Telstra's licence. She said, this decision's too hard for me. You know, Philip Ruddock, you make the decision whether or not they can shut down CDMA. Now, how's that for a Polly Farmer? Isn't that just amazing?
Mm. Why is it a decision for the Attorney General to make?
Well, apparently it's all gone legal. In her press release, the Minister for Communications, her, has authorised the Attorney General, the Honourable Philip Ruddock, to make a decision in relation to the proposed variation of Telstra's carrier licence. Now, that means that they can and can't turn things on and off. Mm. The Telstra has publicly committed to the continuing operation of CDMA network until the NextG network provides equal or better coverage and services, apparently. And a lot of people out there don't believe that that's actually the case. Mark will say that it is the case, but basically Senator Coonan said it's now gone legal.
I think Mark, to be fair, has said that it will be the case, not necessarily that it is yet.
Anyway.
But Mark also warned against dire consequences on this show, exclusively on Tech Talk Radio, that there would be possible dire consequences of keeping the CDMA network open too long because in terms of harming the NextG network.
In that it's using radio frequency spectrum that could be used by NextG.
And antennas and tower space and all the rest of it that could be used by NextG to as the numbers build on NextG.
To improve the network performance of NextG.
That's right.
Speaking of NextG, thanks for the link, boys. Beautiful Anna Corrin segue
did
there.
Do you like that?
The ACCC is taking Telstra to court over the NextG ad claims. Remember, everywhere you need it, and what was the other saying that they used to have?
It wouldn't happen in Australia and all those sorts of good things.
Yeah, no, the ACCC have decided that the claims made in the Telstra commercial are objectionable, and they're actually going to take action. It was in the mainstream media today that the ACCC alleges that Telstra has engaged in misleading or deceptive conduct by representing that the NextG mobile network covers the entire country and has coverage everywhere you need it.
Mm.
So they're going to seek an injunction to stop them from actually saying that anymore, which I thought was quite cute, really, because I thought they'd done it already. So there's the next saga that's heading Telstra's way.
There was a news item similar to that that we had at the top of the show about Sol over in America. He did an interview on CNBC, I think it was, off the top of my head.
Is he suffering foot-in-mouth disease at the moment,
Well, he said that it's the fastest broadband network in the world, which is interesting because the same technology is used in other...
The fastest wireless broadband network.
Is that what he said? I don't know if it's in front of me. No, I think he just said it was the fastest broadband network
in
the world.
Well, that's a claim.
Yeah, and the thing is that the technology is being used all over the world, so in theory, the bandwidth that you can pump through the network is going to be the same.
Mm.
Well, they're going to the next...
I wonder if it's defensible. I wonder if Telstra have implemented it first and no one's ramped up the speeds as far as Telstra has yet.
Well, they're bypassing 14.4 meg and going to 20 megabits per second, apparently. Mm. There's no devices out there that work at that speed
other
yet.
Other networks have not got the backbone to cover it yet or something like that. Mm. There might be a way to get away with it. Anyway, go on.
Out of context here. We don't know.
No. But
yes, you're right. It was in the news tonight. And finally, Telstra sets the watchdog on Coonan. The bizarre ACCC federal government Telstra love triangle that Dr. Ron is so passionate about is really in full swing here this evening. Telstra, continuing its pursuit of the Commonwealth Minister, Helen Coonan, has asked the corporate watchdog to investigate claims of misleading conduct and has threatened further legal action against the senator.
Ooh.
This is why she's handing everything over to Philip.
Well, that's probably a fair and valid reason if she's got a conflict with the legal action, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, apparently Telstra Group General Counsel Will Irving wrote to Senator Coonan chastising her for telling residents in Tasmania and Victoria they were not in a wireless broadband area. Well, they probably aren't because it doesn't cover everywhere. See, that's the thing. Oh, anyway, frustration. That's enough of the Telstra rhetoric tonight, I think.
No, rhetoric.
Rhetoric?
That's a good word. That's a very good word.
Rhetoric. Yeah, you heard it first on Tech Talk Radio. Sony ramps up the high-definition challenge. Let's talk about this for a little while, shall we? Sony said it would launch four models of the new Blu-ray high-definition optical disc recorders in November in Japan as it formats battle with HD DVD sort of heats up. That's the other format that they're sort of challenging.
So, and Sony are not making any more any DVD. They're moving to Blu-ray entirely.
Mm. Well, that's good. I think we need more capacity. You can never have enough capacity on your DVD, or in this case, your high-definition DVD. And there's new high-definition DVD news too, which we'll talk about shortly too.
Speaking of capacity, a 50-gigabyte Blu-ray disc typically holds just over 4 hours of HD TV when the over-the-air MPEG-2 stream is recorded directly to the disc. That's what my media release says.
Okay.
50 gigabytes, it's a lot, isn't it, when we're accustomed to 4.7 on a standard DVD?
It is. The only thing that bothers me about these really big optical discs is the more you put on, the further you fall.
The more you lose when there's a scratch across the disc.
Oh, yes. I wonder if they're using XML technology in there so that you can, if it scratches a bit, just jumps across rather than stops dead in its tracks. But no, anyway, no, that was humour.
We'll have to.
That was humour.
It's a valid point, though. They need to have some sort of error correction and error checking routine. Yes. That's very robust.
Well, as you said, these new models that Sony are about to release are capable of recording 16 hours of high definition on a dual layer 50 gig disc. I think that's what you just said, which is going to be released on November the 8th. And top end machines of these four will sell for around about $2,000 in Australia, roughly in line with Toshiba's flagship HD DVD recorder.
It's still way too pricey. They're not commodity items yet, are
there's,
they?
There's still one major problem too. There's nothing worth recording on them.
Yeah.
only the Chaser boys are there in standard def.
But high def in Australia is about to take a step forward.
Maybe. We've been there, done that.
Huge step forward. Oh, haven't you read the press releases?
Would you like my cynical cap there back, Dr. Ron?
I just passed it over to you. You can pass it back now.
Are we going to mention that briefly?
Well, we're talking about...
We're going to talk about Two Clicks.
Oh, are we? Oh.
Two Clicks, Whirlpool. Now, this is a very interesting
thing.
This
is very close to my heart.
I gestured about this in the forum when Dr. Ron put the plug in for our forum. Well, I'll let you tell the story, Graham, but in essence, what is it? Someone said something which was, to them, factually correct, and that company said, well, you tell the story.
Well, what's happened is, if I can pull out my
Whirlpool
bit of paper,
how would you describe Whirlpool?
Well, they're a forum. They're a...
very well-respected forum in Australia.
A very popular forum for people who... Initially, it was for users of... the Big Pond.
They used to talk about broadband
network,
and things like that.
Talking about Big Pond,
and it's
services.
Evolved into mobile and communications.
And
sort
it
of
covers
chats and
all broadband
ISPs.
And mostly broadband internet connection technologies and different companies. And it's all user forums. And there's lots of, you know, do you prefer this carrier over that? Are you having a problem at the moment? This is the solution to your problem. How do you configure this? Lots of really good, the stuff you get on a really good forum.
Anyway, there was some accounting software made by a company called Two Clicks. And someone decided to start a thread about that.
Well, there were a couple of threads on it talking about Two Clicks or not Two Clicks, and another one called Anyone Use Two Clicks. In a little bit of it's a side forum of the Whirlpool forums talking about Windows software, and some people made some comments that they were having trouble with it and that it didn't quite do what they wanted it to do.
I read those claims. Someone said, don't go anywhere near it because you'll lose hours or something.
Something, there were several along those sorts of lines. And so Two Clicks figured out that they may have lost some sales because of the negative comments. Because if you Google Two Clicks, Whirlpool comes up like right up the top of the responses because their forums are very popular. And if you're thinking of buying Two Clicks software, you Google Two Clicks and you immediately find these negative comments.
I did that before. I'll do it right now while we're on air. Two Clicks, yeah.
So Two Clicks decided to sue. And the person they decided to sue was not the person who made the comments. The poster, the forum contributor.
The author of the comments.
Yep. They didn't sue the Whirlpool website itself. They sued Simon Wright, who runs the Whirlpool forums.
Mm-hmm. But in the media side of things, that would be right. You would not sue directly the author of an article. You would go to the publishing house.
And... in this case, Simon, I believe...
It's the third one down on Google at the moment. Two clicks or not two clicks. There you go.
Right up on the front page. So now the forums, the Whirlpool forums are run as a not-for-profit thing. They're not a commercial entity. They're not out to make money. The guy who's doing this for the benefit of Australian broadband users on the whole is now facing a lawsuit worth $150,000.
Yeah, they're suing for loss of income and bad PR and a bit of extra, I suspect.
Yeah, well, it's interesting actually. If you look at what they claim that they're losing or they lost over the period they're talking about $150,000 per month.
When was this posted?
But then they
let me click the link and I'll tell you.
But then they claim that the total that they're asking for is $150,000. So I'm not sure how their adding up works.
All right. Well, I guess the moral of the story is that we're looking at buyer beware. This is going to set a precedent in law, and it's probably going to be a fairly serious precedent because
it is.
Anybody else who wants to go and publish in an online forum, whether it be ours or anybody else's, it means that we could be liable for what you say. So, and I don't think. Well, I think Adam's got something to say, and he actually does on the couch tonight. So we'll have a listen to Adam's opinion very shortly. But it's going to be very interesting in the future about this sort of stuff.
It's quite bizarre, really. I wondered when I heard this news why we're reinventing the wheel. This sort of thing has been hashed out and settled unconditionally in the United States, and they have legislation over
there. Their laws are different, though, aren't they?
Yeah, and it says that any ISP or any administrator of a forum or anything like that is not responsible for content which is carried by them. Because going down the logic of these of the Two Clicks people, you could then sue the providers who are providing broadband that are distributing this content. You could just get quite carried away, and it's a very it's disturbing that it's got as far as actually the civil writs actually been lodged. It shouldn't have actually got that far.
Yes.
I can't see any future for this, because certainly if they find in favour of the what we call a plaintiff, I think, the person who's actually making the claim.
In other words, Two Clicks.
In other words, Two Clicks. It's going to open up a huge can of worms.
It is.
Oh, well, here we go again. The legal roundabout. See, this is the technology so much in front of the law, isn't it? In all respects. Online, offline, everything.
Mm.
Let's talk about, we mentioned briefly in a couple of shows back about 000, and you said that Senator Coonan was delusional when she gave some interesting numbers. You've got an update for us on that one, Dr. Ron?
I did. I have an apology to make to Senator Coonan and her office. This is actually what we said on the show a few weeks back.
Of callers to 000, and there were around 12 million calls made to 000 in this country. That's nearly one per head of population in this country.
Is that every year?
That was last year.
No, this is annually. Yes, go on.
How many, what percentage of those do you think would be non-genuine emergency situations?
Well, I would have an inside guesstimate at saying probably 80, 85, 90%, something like that.
Oh, that's gutsy.
Was I?
According to Senator Coonan, not quite that bad. She says 60%.
No, Senator Coonan's delusional. It's up. No, I'm sorry. Okay. It's up around the 90% or higher.
Okay.
Mm.
So you were wrong there. Well, sorry.
That's okay. Apologies to Senator Coonan. The figure is more around the 60% at the moment.
She was right, was she?
She was. She was close. The number that I had in my head, which was around 85 to 90%, was probably a few years old. And the number was accurate a few years ago, but two things have happened since that number's come tumbling down to around about the 60%. One thing...
Is this the IVR?
Yeah, one of the things that's happened is the IVR, which means that if there is a call that's placed from a mobile phone and there's no answer there, the Telstra operators put the call through to a system which says if you need emergency assistance, press 55 on your keypad. If the caller presses 55, then they get connected to the police.
So someone listens to it and then puts them through to the IVR?
No, a machine... the Telstra operator does. If they say, hello, there's nobody there, the default action used to be just to extend the call straight to the police, and it was a huge waste of resources.
Recently, I rang 000 from my mobile, and it went straight to the IVR.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know why that would be. It should be answered by a human first under all circumstances.
Okay.
To my understanding.
That's odd, because, I remember I thought, I'm in a queue.
Yeah.
We'll get the next available operator. Yeah. And they played Greensleeves to me, but
Indeed. Maybe the second thing which has actually changed is that in Victoria, certainly, they used to have a series of numbers for emergency attendance which were unique to each emergency service.
That was a good idea, wasn't it?
Well, this is the thing. They used to have 11444 for police. They had 11441 for the fire brigade, and I think they had 11440 for the ambulance. They were very confusing. And
yes,
people were calling them thinking that they were non-emergency numbers. Like, oh, look, I've got a question about when I can burn off with my incinerator and my neighbour's blaring their stereo and I need some advice. And they'd ring this number and they'd go through to the emergency police centre. And that's ridiculous. They didn't need to do that. What they were, the caller was intending to do was get connected to a police station or something like that. So they phased out those numbers. So after they phased out those 1144 numbers in Victoria and also similar numbers interstate, and they've also introduced the IVR, that number of malicious and hoax calls has come tumbling down from the 85 to 90% range down to the 60%-ish area.
Which is a significant improvement.
It's a significant improvement. It's still a hell of a lot of calls, though, that are false or malicious or not required, isn't it?
I think any system's going to have that, though.
I think so. So that was just a clarification of what I said about Senator Coonan and her statistics.
Net Alert. Let's talk about Net Alert then, shall we?
Let's.
Now, what happened, Senator Fielding for the Family First organisation has said something, Dr. Ron.
He has. He was on Melbourne Radio and he was saying that the Net Alert initiative is good. He supported it, but he was a little bit cynical in terms of, why it's taken the government so long to actually come up with it.
Look, it's common sense in the end. Look, at the end of the day, to allow some of these horrible sort of sites just to go open slather to households and libraries across Australia is crazy. And I just think there's other countries that are doing it, and now Australia is finally coming to a bit of common sense, and the Prime Minister has decided before an election to move.
Yes, that was Senator Stephen Fielding of the Family First Party talking on Melbourne Radio
It's a shame that you can't set up a bonfire and burn a website in the same way that you can burn a book, isn't it, Dr. Ron?
I applaud Senator Fielding's... He's well-intentioned. He means well, but by the same token, he's...
I suspect he does. Yes. I'm not sure that that's enough.
This is the same senator that wants to block so-called undesirable content at the ISP level, which, in my opinion, is completely unworkable.
Yes.
Especially if you want to use the internet.
Maybe
we should get Elton John back in.
Yes, the Elton John solution would work, wouldn't it?
Just turn it off.
That'll fix everybody's problem.
Turn the internet off, yes. But he does raise an interesting point. I think he's got a right to be cynical. Why has it taken them so long, 10 years or 15 years to introduce this?
I don't know. How about enforcing some existing laws and standards?
Well, this is it. You could plough the money into enforcing existing legislation. That's right, Grace.
Rule number one, just watch your kids online. Even the thing that irks me, have you seen the federal government's ads on television at the moment promoting safe usage online? Where's the kid? He's in his bedroom.
He's in his room with the screen turned away from the door.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's promoting. Yeah.
Yep. Anyway. That's just not the way to do it.
Welcome to the election year. Now, speaking of elections, there's all sorts of interesting things happening on Google. Now, there's probably too much.
He's also using an iMac. Sorry, just out of.
Oh, on the advertisement, is he?
I think he is.
Oh. Is that a problem?
Well, I think it's just interesting.
Yeah, creative types. Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. The web is gearing up for an election. Google's funding a $30 million moonshot, and Google's planned privacy crusade is all part of the news this week. And, yeah, where do we start? But
Google are all over it again.
Let's have a go at the moonshot here. Google is bankrolling a $30 million contest that could significantly boost the commercial space industry and spur the first non-government flight to the moon. Calling it Moon 2.0, the bulk of the prize will go to the first private company that can land a robotic rover on the moon and beam back a gigabyte of images.
What's the prize?
And video to Earth. So there you go. That's the competition.
What's the prize, though?
Well, that's it. They just get some money, I guess. Google partnered with the XPRIZE Foundation for the Moon Challenge, which is open to companies around the world. The Santa Monica-based non-profit prize institute is best known for hosting Ansari XPRIZE contests. So, I don't know. I guess they're going to give money
for those. So the XPRIZE was the one for getting a person into space, so just beyond the 3 mile high limit or whatever it is, and you had to do it twice within 2 weeks or something. And now the new one is you get
something on the room that they want a gig of video back from the moon
from a little robot, a rover on the moon.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, which is quite a challenge.
Someone's done that on Mars. You reckon? Why don't they
get
a bit further?
You know, but it's actually harder on the moon.
Is
because
it?
On Mars, you've got some kind of atmosphere. If you want to make a soft landing on Mars, you can use parachutes.
And those big bouncy bally things you see in those animations.
Big bouncy bally things, yeah. But parachutes are traditional. You can't use parachutes on the moon because there's no atmosphere.
Oh, lots of soft moon dust to land in, though, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure.
Lots of cheese. If you looked at Google Earth, Google Moon, it's made of cheese.
Yes, I'm not sure whether that actually works in practice.
Maybe that's why they want to send a robot to the moon so that they can actually verify the cheese.
Dig down a little bit and see if they can find the cheese.
The dust wouldn't be all that soft if you hit it at 12,000 kilometres an hour, would it?
And I think that several of the rocks that are jutting out of the dust wouldn't be at all soft.
Wouldn't be at all friendly.
The other thing is that with no atmosphere, you've got little micrometeoroids and things bombarding you from space as well. So you have to make your
Well, they don't care. They just want their gig of pictures.
Yeah, but you'd have to make your rover fairly, well, literally bulletproof to be able to withstand that. So,
well, good luck. I'm sure there'll be some entrepreneurial
universities. I'm sure someone will do it. It'll be fantastic when it's done, yeah.
We had a good rocket range down the road from us here. It's called Woomera. They can send and launch from there if they need to. Probably do a good rate at the moment because we're in an election.
Hello, if you're listening from outback South Australia, that's great.
Google plans privacy crusade, drawing upon its clout as the internet's most powerful company. Google is calling upon businesses and regulators throughout the world to adopt international standards for protecting consumer privacy online and offline. And this is probably because they've had more legal applications in many years, I reckon, to actually try and extract information about what people are doing. So they're trying to get some form of uniformity there.
Now, I'm a big Google fan. I love Google, but the one thing that just makes me slightly nervous is when I hear Google and privacy in the same sentence.
Mm.
Because they're collecting a lot of data somewhere.
Yes. Well, I guess, cynically you can come out and say that, but yes, because every click you go to on your web, you can find it in your what you've searched for in your Google account when you go back and log on.
Yep. Mm.
Now, the other thing, too, a big news in this week is that Google is ramping up the election, as I mentioned in the opening of the show. They've got, if you go to allthegoogle.com.au/election2007, and on the odd chance that you're a iGoogle user.
I Google?
Are you iGoogle guys?
I do.
Do you?
I don't.
Just because you're blankly looking at me, I suspect you have no idea what I'm talking about.
No, I've got one of them. He says pointing at
the iGoogle screen on the desktop.
And I don't. The nice purple cityscape across the top.
In essence, for those of you who don't know about iGoogle, you can customize your Google search. Instead of just the white screen with the word Google and a thing where you type your search in there, you can actually put applets on it or little maplets or whatever they like to call it. And
so you can cover it with news stories and photographs and pretty things and make it look like 9MSN and you're back where you started. Oh, dear.
You are so cynical, Graeme Callaghan.
I'm sorry.
I've got the iGoogle up here, and I've chosen the 2007 election tab as recommended by Google to actually sit here on my screen, and I can see the latest. What they do is they categorize all the videos from YouTube and all the political parties. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tabs across the top of the little Google thing, and it indexes all the political party ads in order. And the thing is, with YouTube, there is no form of credibility check on any of the allegations or claims that are made on YouTube. My background, if you don't know, is commercial television. We make a lot of TV ads and things like that. Now, everything we make must go through an organisation called Free TV Australia, based in Sydney.
It's going to be broadcast on television.
Yes.
But these people that are making these.
So when you see the little white super on the end of the television commercial that says written, spoken and authorised by Dr. Ron for the federal... Yep. That's a requirement of Free TV Australia. So there's a telltale sign. If you don't see that on the YouTube clips, you know that they may be making some claims that they shouldn't. Because any claim that you make on commercial television must be substantiated. Absolutely must. So send a big cheerio to Ruth up there. She's probably got her hands full at the moment with all these television commercials coming through. So go and have a look at that. Also, just briefly, there's you can see your seat. You can have a little maplet for Google Maps where you can overlay your seat and see things like that. It's also got an Australian election trends where you can map...
Well, who's winning?
At the moment, it's pretty much the blue line is hitting the red line. So I'd say they're even Stevens as to the one which has come up on the screen at the moment. But and then also down the bottom there, you can actually use the Google search engine for what it's actually supposed to be used for. And that is you can choose a senator or someone who's running for the one of the federal seats and select a topic or type your own topic in, and it will return any document about anything they may have said in public or in Parliament about it. So you can find out what their stance is on certain issues. But wait, there's more.
Hi, and welcome to Google Australia's new 2007 federal election page. Our Australian engineers have developed some really innovative tools to help you access and digest information for this coming federal election.
Let's take a closer look at the special version of Google Maps called a Maplet. Once you add it, you'll be taken to Google Maps with the data from this Maplet overlaid on top. You can see the electorate boundaries appear with the seat name label for each electorate. To see which parties currently hold each seat in Australia, just click the party shading box. If you want to find your specific electorate, you can do so by entering your full address or just your postcode. You could also select your seat name from the drop-down menu to go directly to it.
At your seat, you can find out about your sitting member and their margin, a short electorate profile, and a number of other cool links to video, news, and candidate sources. For the political junkies, we've also included some fun features. For example, this federal election is going to be won or lost in the marginal electorates. So to see where the battles will be waged, you could select the seats with margins under 6%. You can also view electorate boundaries and seat names in Google Earth. Just download the KML file and it will appear as an Earth layer.
If you want to fact find even more and make sure you're always kept up to date, we have also developed a range of gadgets for you to add to your personalised iGoogle homepage. You can pick and choose which ones you want to add or simply accept them all by adding the election tab. Our first gadget is called Australian MPs on the Record. It allows you to select an MP and an election issue, then run an advanced Google search about what they've said in Parliament or what they've said on their own personal websites.
Our second gadget is called Election Trends. This gadget lets you select various topics and compare both search and news query volumes over time to see when particular topics are hot and when they're not.
Our third gadget provides news from your seat straight to your iGoogle homepage, while our final gadget showcases Australian political YouTube channels. In keeping with the YouTube theme, be sure to check out the channels for each of the main political parties.
And that wraps up everything. We hope you enjoy using these tools and that they help you make an informed vote this federal election.
And I've had a lot of fun playing with them, and they're very good. And if you're a political junkie, and I must admit, I would sort of put my hand up. I sit and watch the Electoral Office website on an election night because it's a lot of fun.
Oh, really?
I don't watch any of the television programs or anything like that because the electoral site is good. But I'm quite looking forward to using the Google tools this time around. So there you go. There's an update. That's what Google is spending a lot of money putting together, an Australian web page, all to keep us up to date on what's going on. Hopefully they're unbiased. I'm sure they are because they're just using their juggernaut search engine to deal with those sort of things.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil?
That's their... That's motto, isn't
Google's
it?
Google's supposed motto, isn't it?
Don't be evil.
Search results for good rather than evil.
Exactly.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. All right, Adam Turner had a look at Web 2.0 and I guess the thing we were discussing a little bit earlier on, two clicks and all that sort of stuff. It is a bit of a minefield that's sort of seeming to emanate this day and age. So here's Adam's view from the couch for this week and we'll be back with more in a moment.
Adam Turner's view from the couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Web 2.0 is all about social networking and user-generated content, but letting readers comment on your website is becoming a legal minefield. A few weeks ago, readers on a sports forum sparked off a legal storm when they named the AFL club at the centre of a drug scandal, even though the courts had ordered the media not to reveal the name of the club. Now, popular web forum Whirlpool is being sued due to comments made by readers on the site. Whirlpool has for many years been the definitive source of information for those researching broadband in Australia. It's grown into one of the country's most well-known and respected technology forums, with almost 200,000 members. Whirlpool contributors such as Dan Warren have gone to work in the mainstream media. Whirlpool has always been controversial, especially over its attacks on Telstra's terrible customer service and value for money. This kind of tell-it-how-it-is attitude can get you into trouble. Whirlpool is being sued by Two Clicks, developers of an accounting software package who are unhappy with the criticisms of their product by readers on the Whirlpool forums. If you type Two Clicks, the number 2, C-L-I-X, into Google, the first hit is the Two Clicks website, but the next three are links to the Two Click discussions on Whirlpool. The statement of claim from Two Clicks alleges that Whirlpool founder Simon Wright allowed false and malicious statements relating to Two Clicks to be published on the Whirlpool forums. Two Clicks said the comments led to a severe downturn in monthly sales. It specifically referenced more than 30 comments by Whirlpool users, many strongly advising people to avoid the software at all costs and complaining that advertised features were not actually available in the product. As a result, Two Clicks is suing Whirlpool for at least $150,000 plus costs and is demanding the two forum threads be removed from the site. If Two Clicks wins its case, it could have major legal ramifications. Many websites may decide it's not worth the legal risk of letting users leave comments, which could kill one of the greatest aspects of the internet revolution. The web's interactivity is what makes it so appealing, and it's even forcing the mainstream media outlets to move away from the we speak, you listen style of journalism. all that could be gone if TwoClicks wins this case. Now, TwoClicks is certainly entitled to sue if it thinks it's been wronged. I don't think the web should be immune from the legal system. I've removed comments from my blogs that were clearly defamatory, but it's difficult to know where to draw the line. If TwoClicks win, we need a very clear judgment so as not to give companies open slather to sick their lawyers on anyone who dares question them. Australians don't have a protected right to free speech like they do in the US, so we're relying on the judges to make good decisions to ensure that litigious companies don't gag online debate just because they don't like what they hear. The web is all about saying what you think. Let's hope it stays that way.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Windows has come up for Sun. How about that?
Sorry,
Sun.
What?
Windows has come up for Sun. Sun Microsystems, you know them, don't you?
I know Sun Microsystems, they wrote Java.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Sun Microsystems apparently will begin building servers with one-time foe Microsoft's Windows operating system installed directly inside them.
Oh, no, that's not right.
That's definitely Worlds Collide stuff, isn't it?
It doesn't sit well with me.
Sun and Microsoft are enemies.
Hearing the words Windows and Sun in the same sentence doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, there you go.
Why is this so, boys? Why is this so? Maybe they've seen the dark side. Or, you know, could be worse. I mean, with Apple.
Yeah, well, I think they could. But who's seen whose dark side?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? Apparently, the agreement is the latest twist in a truce between the companies, once bitter and twisted rivals. I added the word twisted. Hammered out in 2004 when Sun pocketed, apparently, $2.5 billion Australian dollars in a settlement payout from Microsoft over antitrust and patent allegations, with both companies vowed to make their products work better together.
Yes, because Microsoft wrote their own Java engine, their own little Java client to run with Windows and Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
And Sun said, no, that's ours. You can't have that.
Do you want to tell everyone what Java is? Just so that those who aren't quite sure about what Java is.
Java's a little programming language, and it's used a lot for scripting and small applications. And it's used in a way as platform independent. So your Java application can run on a Windows machine or on an Apple Macintosh or on a Linux machine or on your phone. Or it'll run where you put it. And it's used a lot in part of web applications to do things that the web browser itself isn't smart enough to do.
I think I've had two prompts already this evening on the machine here in the studio to upgrade to the new version of Java. They're prolific. They're just as bad as Microsoft.
When you do, just remember to untick the box to download all that Google extra rubbish that comes with it, because you don't need it.
Hang on, you've used Google and rubbish in the one sense, Graham.
I
must admit, I'm not a big fan of the toolbar.
I'm bitter and twisted about the Google toolbar that gets bundled in with everything. I uninstall it.
Well, that's because Google pay for the bundling. They get a kick from it, so, you know.
Yes.
But that's how Alexa works, isn't it? Remember how we had the website of the week last week, which was Alexa, and they monitor everyone's, you know, the popular websites around the world?
It's a bit of aggro about that on the forum.
Really?
Yeah, people saying, no, you can't use Alexa, it's a virus. So it's not a virus, it's spyware. And people's spyware software detects it and gives people warnings about it.
Fair enough, if that's what it is. But that's how they do their...
But Alexa on their website has an FAQ, a frequently asked questions section, that says... Are you spyware? No, we're not spyware.
Well, of course they're going to say that.
But they say we don't push ourselves onto people. You go to our website to download it and you install it, and then if you want to uninstall it, you can.
But the cynics amongst it could say that's how it all happens anyway. Someone tricks you into downloading stuff.
You need to make an informed decision for yourself. The other thing with Java...
Well, I'm glad we've got a lot of talk about it. That's good.
Yeah. Java, not to be confused, and this is a common
source
of confusion, with JavaScript, which is something totally different.
What's the difference?
It's a JavaScript's a language, programming language.
But isn't that what you just said, Graham?
It is kind of what I just said. The Java I was talking about.
There's a lot of confused
is
people
an environment
out there
as well.
That's right. Java is an environment.
The environment in which the language runs, as well as the language itself.
But JavaScript is a programming language that people use traditionally for
Webby's user.
Yeah, web pages and things like that. two different beasts.
Yeah, now you confused absolutely everybody.
Yes. Sorry about that. Including me. Never mind.
A little Java applets too, we should mention, are very popular on mobile phone devices under the Symbian operating system. You know, so if you, chances are, if you get Google Maps on your mobile phone, it'll be running on Java, won't it, boys?
And that little picture of a coffee mug with the steam coming off it comes up on the screen.
Yes.
That means Java's loading up.
It does.
In other news this week, no short-term mobile risks, apparently.
Oh, good.
Mobile phones do not pose short-term health risks, but it remains too soon to say whether they can cause brain cancer or whether children face greater risks than adults. Sorry, there's a visual gag in the studio here and I missed it.
Graham's got his mobile phone in one hand, some masking tape in the other hand. He's taping it at the side of his head.
Publishing the largest UK investigation into possible health problems from mobile technology, scientists said the six-year program found no evidence that short-term mobile phone use affected brain functions or could cause brain cancer. One of the things I want to know, we all talk about using mobile phones up around our ears and our head.
Yes.
What happens when you keep it in your pocket down that region? Because mobile phones still talk down there, and probably for us boys it's probably more pertinent than it is for the girls, but there's radiation down there, isn't there?
There is radiation, and even if you're not using your mobile phone,
it still chatters and talks.
It still talks to the network, and it's still transmitting.
Well, that can have happy side effects or unhappy side effects depending on how you look at it, but we might not go into that. Well, I keep mine in my shirt pocket right over my heart, so what does that say?
You're going to get breast cancer?
I suppose so. Oh, that's a worry. Well, now I'm depressed.
Do you have chest pain?
Yeah.
At this minute, no.
Is your face sagging? I know there's a big campaign about that at the moment too, isn't there, for the strokes and things?
Yeah, it's to recognise if someone's had a stroke. That's right.
Oh, look, it's a bit like breathing air, isn't it, in a lot of respects? You sort of go out there and you breathe a bit of carbon monoxide. It's got to be bad for you, but yet we still do it every day.
It's funny that they're examining the long-term side effects of mobile phone use, but long-term is only since we've had mobile phones at the longest, surely, which is, what, 10 years or 12 years at the most? We've had phones that we can hold in our hand and hold up to our head.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Before we had those sorts of phones.
So I wonder what happens if you use them for 50 years.
Well, this is it. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, obviously, they can do accelerated tests in a lab, but...
But you won't really know.
You won't really know in the real world.
So what we're running is a big experiment.
That's right.
Find out what happens.
Correct. It's exciting, isn't it?
And you and I are the lab rats.
Yeah. You excited?
I am.
I am.
Goodness me.
Advancing scientific knowledge.
Well, speaking of lab rats, yes. Spam, that's the one. I heard there was another thing called bacon the other day, BACN, which is spam that's actually relevant to you, but you just put it away to read later on.
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
It was from one of the papers.
Oh, anyway. What does it stand for?
I have no idea. I just heard it.
Okay.
I just thought I'd throw that in and see if anyone else had heard it, but obviously not, so we'll move on. The US in Virginia's law banning the massive distribution of junk email is an unconstitutional barrier to free speech.
Oh, whatever.
This is what the lawyers are saying over there. So
you Americans and your crazy free speech laws.
Yeah, we heard in America. Just
nothing of the sort in Australia. It's
as demonstrated in Queensland.
Demonstrated in Queensland. It's an alien concept to us.
Good, I'm glad I mentioned that.
People think that they've got rights here, a lot of rights that they don't constitutionally or legislatively have.
Can I just mention something? We did a little test at in our private residence recently. We took the no junk mail sticker off the letterbox.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I couldn't believe the amount of paper that went straight from the mailbox into the recycling bin without
incoming.
Even being looked at.
So yes. You mean that people did that in the past have been taking notice of it?
The sort of physical equivalent of the Do Not Call register actually works, I've come to the conclusion.
Well, there you go.
It's only the local newspaper that they tend to ignore it, but hey, that's all right. I don't mind reading the local newspaper from time to time. It actually has some relevance in it about
things. Asking the delivery person then to make a judgment as to whether what they're delivering is junk mail or not.
I wonder if they can be prosecuted for that. Someone's nodding. That's not good for radio, Dr. Ron. You've got to speak into the microphone.
I have it on good authority that it's if you actually deliver unsolicited mail into a real-world physical mailbox where there is a sign prominently displayed saying no junk mail or no unsolicited mail, please, you're committing a very serious offence and you can be fined a very hefty sum.
When you say, you mean the retailer that has had its paper put in there or the person that actually puts the paper in there?
Correct. Both.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So the big variety store up in the corner and little Billy who's doing his pocket money.
That's right. And you'll find if you are little Billy and you're listening, you'll probably have been told if you're delivering junk mail, and I used to do a junk mail round when I was working my way through uni.
Oh, no, we've still got Buyer's Ed coming out of the ears.
the Buyer's Ed campaign, that was great.
That's
the
right.
The washing detergent.
You dropped them all around at our place, if I recall. We've still got some left.
About 20 years ago, we're still using Buyer's Ed to wash our clothes. That's true. The people that actually run the distribution of the advertising material, they'll say to you, do not under any circumstances deliver anything to a letterbox where it says, no junk mail, just move on. And if you're in doubt, just move on. Don't put anything in the letterbox. Because, yeah, it's a degree of littering, like a commercial littering offence. Like, there's an offence in Victoria called aggravated littering, and there's a commercial level one as well, which is they get fined huge amounts of money by the EPA if they're caught.
I've seen, I was driving down one of the big freeways here in town today too, and there was people cleaning up alongside the road, and they had a big sign on the back of their truck saying, if you see someone litter, please call this number. So there you go. Is that aggravated littering? Hiffing something out of the car as you drive past?
I'd have to get my copy of the EPA Act out in front of me to tell you, but...
Okay, very good. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more in a moment.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Andrew McComb.
Well, there's a good solution to a problematic outcome, really, isn't it? Does the word bitter and twisted mean anything to you?
Dr. Ron.
We're nothing here if not fashion conscious.
Graham Callaghan.
It's monkeys in the cage.
Am I being cynical
here? Got something thrown at her and she's thrown something back.
Mark Diggins.
No longer going to be a phone call bundle. It's going to be much data can I buy? Well, what's the cheapest megabyte type of thing? And then I'll just make all my calls on Skype.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Graham, my internet's broken. So, no, well, it's not broken. It's
Elton John shut it down.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Open source, OOXML and the likes. We had Sarah Bond in talking about all sorts of things from Microsoft of recent times.
That's right, we did.
And I think it's all good. The problem is we have many standards. Microsoft are trying to push their bandwagon in Europe, isn't it? Where they have their own flavour of OpenOffice XML.
They're trying to get it ratified as an official standard.
Ratified or ratified?
One of the two.
It's one of those nights tonight, isn't it? Yes. Anyway, it's interesting to see where we're going to end up with this, and who knows in the next little bit, but I'm sure Microsoft being the giants that they are will probably try and do anything. Because as they keep saying, that 80% of the world's documents currently stored in binary files on people's desktops and the likes in the form of a .doc file. And they seem to think that, yeah, why not?
Maybe there's a better way.
Well, there is, apparently. Adam Turner caught up with some winemakers of all places. He hit the road.
Oh, yes.
And he was up in the Hunter Valley last week when I spoke to him on the phone. He rang me to say he was in the Hunter Valley having a great time.
He gets around, doesn't he?
He does. Anyway, he was knocking back a couple of shards and he bumped into, what's his name? I'm just trying to find on my rundown. Bill Robinson from DePortley's. They're a great wine company.
Oh, they're the wine company. Yes.
Yeah, and apparently they're a big user of OpenOffice XML, and this is what transpired over a couple of shards.
I'm in the Hunter Valley this week at the Media Connect IT conference, and I'm talking to Bill Robinson, who's the IT technology manager at DePortley Wines. Now, DePortley are big users of open source, and Bill and his team at DePortley have been following what's happening with Microsoft's Office Open XML format. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, Adam. Yep, thank you.
Do you want to maybe explain to listeners a little bit about what Microsoft's Office Open XML format is trying to achieve and what's happened recently in the news with that?
I think there's the reasons why Microsoft are trying to achieve this is probably going to come down to the eye of the beholder. What the stated intention is, which is notable, is trying to maintain the ability of documents to be opened into the future. The IT industry has had such a short history that people don't understand that a lot of what we, when we store data in binary formats, whether they're Excel spreadsheets or Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheets or WordPerfect documents, there's no guarantee that we can actually open those documents into the future. The perfect example of this is probably the National Archives of Australia. If they have cabinet documents that they archive away, they've got to be able to open those documents in 30 years' time when they're released. There may not be an Excel in 30 years' time. So they convert their files into a international standard for XML, ISO standard 2600, which is an XML standard for making sure that those documents don't just die the same as trying to use a Betamax VHS now or anything that's been recorded onto old technologies.
So basically it's a universal language.
It's trying to be open.
And Microsoft aren't the first people to develop a format like this, though, are they?
That's where the complication comes in. There's already an existing standard for XML documents and spreadsheets, and it's the ISO standard 26300. It was originally donated by Sun Microsystems. It's used by OpenOffice, the free Office productivity suite. I know IBM's also bundling the, it's called ODF, the Open Document Format, providing ODF support into Lotus Notes. There's certainly several open source suites that are now all migrating to ODF. And some of the governments throughout Europe have been mandating standards because they're starting to panic. The European governments talk about having to a legal obligation to maintaining their documents for 80 years. And as I said, the history of computing has been so short, this concept that we have to actually be able to read a document in 80 years' time. The example I gave before, if somebody had a movie on Betamax and tried to play it now, or the 8-track cartridge tapes, or technology moves so quickly, if you've got data saved on obsolete formats or proprietary formats, you may be in trouble in the future.
So this all sounds like a great thing, but as you say, there are two competing formats. Now, what are the concerns with Microsoft's open format?
I think it's probably been two concerns. One is Microsoft's problem is that they have to provide backwards compatibility with their other products. And to provide that backwards compatibility, it seems, from what I can understand, that their Office Open XML actually allows the capability of non-open data embedded inside it, which means it's nothing more than a simple wrapper around proprietary data anyway. So it doesn't actually solve the problem for end users, it just ticks a box with governments. The other problem, of course, is the fact that it's having two standards for the same thing only adds confusion, where from a user perspective, it would seem that the better approach would be to adopt the existing standard. I'm assuming for a combination of business reasons this didn't suit Microsoft's approach where they were going. The most interesting part out of all of it was where, as I said, Microsoft were trying to fast-track this through the standards organisations around the world. There's been a little bit of concern about the approach that's been taken, what seemed to be some gaming of the system, but I think one of the most interesting proposals that came out was actually the French standards organisations actually proposed that they break Microsoft's approach into two pieces, one that is just generally open for going forward, and to merge that, have a three-year plan to merge that with the existing standard and have one unified standard going forward, and then to provide a second extension that provides the proprietary compatibility that Microsoft needs for its backwards compatibility. And that's really interesting.
But if you're an open source person and you're already using these ODF formats, then you wouldn't really think it was necessary to go through that long process that you were just talking about, because it seems like what Microsoft are trying to do has already been done, and they're trying to reinvent the wheel with Microsoft written on it.
It's not all bad news. The intriguing thing is what they're trying to do may not necessarily, on the surface, be particularly good. It's certainly a nuisance to have two standards for the same things, the same as if you had cars driving left and right-handed on the same roads, or, duplicating standards is nearly as silly as duplicating infrastructure. What it has done, though, has enlivened the whole open standards debate. We, as a company, are very heavy adopters of open source, but a lot of the time that's misread. The open source is often used as a tactical tool to actually drive home open standards. And the real value that you can get out of IT is when you can start interoperating various components. I can buy a router from Cisco, I can buy a switch from 3Com, I can buy a PC from Dell, I can buy a service from HP, plug them all together and they work. This is different to how it was in the past. I come out of the IBM mid-range and Unisys mainframe world where you bought stuff from a particular vendor and you implemented the network. It was token ring and you had to buy all your components from IBM. And it was horrifically expensive and you couldn't connect equipment easily from different vendors, and it really limited your flexibility. It really limited what you could do. For probably any non-tech listeners, the example would be you wouldn't buy a car from a car manufacturer. You wouldn't buy a Ford if Ford said as part of the conditions, oh, this only runs on Ford petrol. Oh, it only runs on Ford roads. Oh, and it only runs with Ford tyres. That's the difference. The, you know, all of, we expect this in the non-IT world, that that various products will play nicely or play nice enough together that we can plug our fridge into the PowerPoint and the voltages work because they're agreed that these are going to be the voltages. But in the IT world, we have these bizarre scenarios, and the approach is not in the long term, or don't appear to always be in the long term best interest. And it, again, it sounds like Microsoft bashing. They're a good company. They're just the latest in a line of monopolies. In the 70s, it was IBM. No one got fired for buying IBM. In the 90s, it was Microsoft. I think the future probably belongs to Google. And in the future, we'll probably look at Google and say, well, that was a bugger, them being a monopoly. But at least with the, we're finding with the Google technologies is they play nicely with others. And that's all we're asking for, is that these kids in the sandpit, you know, will play nicely and won't take the bucket and spade and go home.
So what's happened with Microsoft's latest format is the Office Open XML is they tried to fast track it through the process to become an international standard. Now they hit a few snags there. Can you tell me what happened?
I don't know how much of it came down to politics or and I'm guessing just the fast tracking in something like the International Standards Organization is not as easy, and there probably were questions asked as to, well, why are we running two standards for the same things? So certainly Microsoft were keen to get, you know, their standard pushed through, and coincidentally there's a lot of countries around the world seem to be suddenly interested in voting for technology standards and standards bodies around the world that weren't previously interested in technology standards have suddenly changed their membership status to be able to vote on this. I again don't necessarily see it all as a bad thing, because what happens is it's probably, and it's enlivened the debate about standards. Sometimes it's like a pantomime. You probably need, you know, the bad villain running around that people can actually, you know, understand, you know, what's going on in this story. And in this case, yes, a lot of the approaches have certainly upset a lot of people in the open source area in particular. I know a lot of my staff were fairly upset with what they saw as an attempt to game the international standards processes.
Has Microsoft's attempts to get this standard through failed or just hit a hurdle? What happens from here?
My understanding is it's just a delay in the process, that it's gone to the first stage fast tracking has failed. They had to achieve two majorities. They failed in both, one just slightly and the other at a fair level. And it now goes into a review process. The actual national standards bodies have said, you know, no, but with, you know, technical considerations have to be taken into account. So those technical considerations will now go back to committees to be reviewed. As I said, the most interesting one that came out of that was the French proposal for actually saying, well, maybe we should be working towards one unified standard than two standards, one of them which will only suit one particular vendor more than others, because it seems a little against the spirit, at least, of open standards to actually have a vendor-biased standard, no matter how much market share that vendor has, you know, in the world market.
Well, it definitely sounds like one to keep an eye on. Well, thank you very much for your time, Bill.
Okay, well, Adam, thank you. Cheers.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Let's hope Google plays nicely. That's good. Thank you very much to Adam for that report from the Hunter.
That was a good one. That clarified a couple of issues, didn't it?
It was.
Thanks to Bill Robinson from De Bortoli.
De Bortoli's. Mm. Yes, it was very interesting, actually. He put it very well, I thought, in respect to the open office XML formats. Why do we need two? That's the question that the Europeans are asking Microsoft at the moment. The French, how about that? The French came out and said, yeah, we don't think you need two. So that's good. Well, and the hurdles that they're obviously going to try and overcome. It'd be interesting to see if they have success there. And, of course, I did try and mention that to Sarah Bond in recent times, but got the standard Microsoft answer. Yes, we work hard with everybody. So there you go. Did you get anything brilliant out of that, boys?
I think it was all fair comment. It was a considered opinion there from Bill. I certainly think I've used the Open Office formats. I haven't used Office Open XML formats, though.
Well, we're talking about future-proofing here, aren't we? Mm. This is where it's got its advantages. That is, OpenOffice is a plain format that can be read in a text editor. Like, you can't read a doc file in a text editor or anything like that. Mm. And every part of the XML format has a little tag that says, this is the picture, and it puts a bit of a picture there. Here's some text, and here's the formatting and things like that. So if something happens to that file in time, then you've got half a chance of being able to recover some of it. Whereas if a binary file, like a doc file at the moment, falls over, you got two chances.
Exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
If I find a floppy disk at home and it's got...
Have you still got those?
Well, in a junk box somewhere.
I don't even think I've got a machine with a drive in it.
If it's got data on it that's in WordPerfect 5.1 format, I would have zero to no hope of being able to read it. And if it had important information in it, or if there was, say, a university essay on there from years and years back, and I thought, it'd be interesting just to open that up and have a look, I wouldn't be able to. The data's gone.
Yet once upon a time, WordPerfect 5.1 was the gold standard. If you weren't using that, you weren't doing word processing.
This is exactly right. This is before Word 6.0, I think. That's where we sort of moved across from WordPerfect, but it's a very real problem.
When we started using Windows.
Mm, exactly.
Gray Knowlton is the group product manager from Microsoft Open and Microsoft Office, and here's his comments about OpenOffice XML.
In fact, it's a very popular thing to say that Microsoft owns or controls parts of these specifications, and the entire purpose for taking this document format into a standards-based environment is to specifically avoid this. It is precisely to ensure that people have the ability to read and write documents using this format free from encumbrance from something that Microsoft would own.
That was posted up on one of the forums, and they're still talking about different flavors of it and not quite working.
I'm not actually sure that's quite right what he said.
Exactly. But I thought I'd put it there out in the forum because write a reply for everybody.
Absolutely. Can I make one other comment that just in the last little while, IBM have thrown their weight behind the OpenOffice.org project.
Yeah.
So they've joined that little party. So they'll be contributing code and
wasn't there a free download of OpenOffice? Well, I think Google was doing it and without the support or something. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
OpenOffice.org is a free download from wherever you get it from, and or you can choose to sell it for money if you want to, but you probably wouldn't get very far. But it's interesting that IBM isn't yet another big name to get on board with that project. So going ahead in leaps and bounds. OpenOffice.org is well worth a look if you don't want to pay the $600 to get Office on your machine. Then OpenOffice.org is a perfectly usable, valid alternative.
We're going to talk about television very shortly. You touched on this earlier on in the show. High definition. There's new things coming along. So stay with us. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan, and myself, Andrew McComb.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb, Dr. Ron and Graham Callaghan, the panel this evening. Let's talk about high-definition television, or the lack thereof in this country.
HDTV.
News this week, Australians are set to enjoy two new free-to-air television channels with the 7 and 10 networks, both launching high-definition multi-channeling in December. This is a bit of a breakaway. This is where you can see something different rather than the same content on all the other channels.
Yeah, but are we really? We've been hearing about this for a long time, and the networks have been legislated out of this as an option for a long time.
Well, according to Adam Turner, our guru on the field, currently 10 and 7, their high-definition channels, channel 12 and 70 respectively, are always in sync with the main standard definition channels. And if the program screening on the main channel isn't available in high definition, such as an old movie, the high-definition channel still broadcasts the same standard def program.
Yes.
But apparently as of December, 7 and 10's high definition channels plan to break synchronisation with the main channels for several hours each day, most likely when the program screening on the main channel isn't available in high definition.
But are they allowed to do this now?
Well, excuse me.
Apparently they are.
The laws changed in 2009. Where we can do the breakaway. But as at the moment, if you look at, say, ABC2, for example, ABC2 can't run certain programs because of the competition side of things with the others, but yet they can run documentaries such as, you know, repeats of Chaser. Not that's a documentary, that's comedy and entertainment. They can run you know, Australian stories and things like that on their other channels. And I suspect this is really what the free-to-airs are going to do. We're going to start seeing some interesting things.
So they might run a rerun of a high-def program when there's a standard-def program on the main channel.
Well, that's potentially on the cards, really, isn't it? So, look, it'll all be very interesting to see what happens because this
it'll be very interesting to see what the schedule looks
like. In the next 12 months or so, where statutes run out or, you know, timelines kick into the new things, we should start seeing multi-channeling sort of kick in big time here. So,
and did I see that Channel 7 are upgrading their high to from sort of halfway high definition to all the way high definition just in time for the Olympics?
Yeah, there was a rumour of that as well, too. Yes, I remember. I read something about that, but I can't remember. And the TiVo. The TiVo is not going to skip ads in Australia either. Did you hear about that?
No, yes, I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what's going on here. I wonder if this is all a fallout because of ICE TV and the free TV guide and all that.
You'll be able to fast-forward the ads like you can fast-forward any of the things you've recorded.
Oh, that's right, you mentioned it in the news.
Yeah, apparently,
I should have paid more attention.
Yeah, well, apparently the US version, which our one's going to be modelled on, lets you actually press a skip button and you can jump from one part of the program over the advertisements straight to the start of the next bit. So they must have something in the actual transmission which marks the start and the end of advertisements for the TiVo to be able to do that, surely.
It'll be done digitally, I reckon.
Possibly. I don't think there's an actual, because it wouldn't suit the networks to put a signal in there to identify it, but I think it looks for something like the fade to black at the end of the ads before the main program comes back and things like that.
Makes an educated guess, you think.
That's a very gutsy call because there's a lot of movies which have black in it. A lot of supers on television which just have black in it. Look at the electoral commercials.
You'd want to record the whole thing and then do it manually when you were watching it, wouldn't you? You wouldn't want to trust the machine to make a decision while it was recording.
Well,
I'm not sure.
You'd have to have a look at how it worked and how good it was.
Let us know.
Of course, it's not going to work in Australia, so we're not going to get the chance.
It's all very hypothetical. If you know, if you own a TiVo in the US and you're listening, let us know. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au.
Further to your comments, Graeme, Seven also plans to launch a high-definition multi-channeling in December. But the network has been less forthcoming with its details. Currently, Seven's high-definition broadcasts are in 576p, which is progressive, as opposed to what Dr. Ron calls it, whereas 10's broadcast in true high-definition is 1080i, which is 1,080 lines, I for interlaced, P for progressive. For those people who aren't quite sure what the difference is between progressive and interlaced, interlaced is what we're currently watching on standard analog television. If you get up there and have a really good look at it, you'll see little black lines in between everything, where you know, the television does the odd lines first, followed by the even lines, and that equals a frame. So you've got two fields per frame.
But how many times does it do that in a second?
50 in the PAL television, where we have 25 frames a second, it does it 50 times a second.
Right.
So that's interlaced. Now, if you go and have a look at your computer screen, that'll be progressive. Pretty schmick-looking stuff. You don't see black lines or anything like that. And the key to it, I think we were talking about this recently too, was refresh times on some of these machines. You get a good, you know, high-definition plasma or something like that. Your refresh times is really what it's all about. Otherwise, your motion looks a bit steppy. So you go and buy it. You remember buying computer screens? And they used to boast 16 millisecond refresh times.
That's 8
millisecond refresh times. And I think we're down to 4s and 2s now.
Yeah, the lower the better, wasn't it?
Lower the better, especially when it comes to progressive scanning technology, which is what true high definition is. You know, we're looking at, in Australia, 25p, which is progressive, 30p for the US market, and for the real Luddites out there, feature films, 24 frames per second. It's always been a problem. Did you ever notice that when you were a kid growing up, that the films always ran shorter on telly than they did in the cinema? Boy, you'd lose a frame every second. Didn't you feel ripped off?
Did that bother you, did it?
No, not at all.
As a child?
Not at all. But I just thought people would be going, yeah, there's something missing in my life and that's it.
What I notice is that the pitch of the voices, you hear an American TV program played in Australia, the voices are just that little bit faster, a little bit higher pitched.
Oh, and that's good. We can get them
over. You hear the original American and the voices are a little bit lower.
Anyway, there you go. All right, we're going to move on and do the a couple of interesting things like the website of the week and gadget and all that in just a few moments. But something came in the news today which just absolutely You get these funny news stories. It should be an odd spot, but Dr. Ron's got an odd spot this evening, so I thought I'd bring this in a bit earlier.
Super bonus extra odd spot.
This is the extra, version. A man dies during a net binge.
Oh.
A net on the internet. Like, just check you've got a pulse, guys, because if you haven't, I'd be worried.
Did he forget to eat or something?
A man in South China collapsed and died.
Right.
After a three-day marathon online session at a cyber cafe.
Was he playing Warcraft?
They didn't say what he was playing. He could have been doing one of any things, really. But apparently the guy, he was around about 30, he just suddenly collapsed in front of his computer terminal in a province in Guangdong because, you're looking at a computer screen for 30 hours playing a game or something like that. And I'm sure that's what it would have been. And that'll do it to you every time. So the moral of the story is, don't play games.
Remember
for over
to get up
hours.
Once in a while and have a drink of water and something to eat.
it's amazing, isn't it? But like, you've got to go to the toilet, you've got to eat.
Well, you'd
think
so, wouldn't you?
Well, maybe if you don't eat, you don't have to go to the toilet. But like,
it's like being on an aeroplane for 24 hours and you don't move, and then you stand up and you can get clots and things like that, blood clots, can't you?
Maybe that's what's happened to this guy.
Yeah, he hasn't moved for 30 hours apart from
his clicking
apart from
finger,
clicking and alt tabbing and stuff.
And some other interesting news that came in this week. Yes. Prince. Or the performer formerly known as Prince. Remember him? Yes. Oh, Purple Rain and stuff?
The guy formerly known as Prince.
Yeah, well, he figures it's good enough to have a go at YouTube. They're going to sue them too now. US pop star Prince plans to sue YouTube and other major websites for unauthorized use of his music in a bid to reclaim his art on the internet. It's another one from Elton John's stable, I suspect.
Art?
Right. Yeah, art. It's use the word loosely there. The man behind the hit songs Purple Rain, 1999, When Doves Cry, said that YouTube could not argue that it had no control under which videos users posted on its site. Well, I think this is a sign of the times, isn't it? We've had this discussion about record companies before. And artists before.
I thought YouTube had agreements with record companies these days.
Well, maybe they do. It's Google. They got deep pockets.
All record companies. Interesting.
Google just buy them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Pay them off.
Who owns the Beatles labels these days?
$10 billion go away?
Because isn't Beatles Michael up Jackson, on YouTube yet or anything like that? No one's got the rights to YouTube Beatles, has they? Michael Jackson used to own them, and he hasn't sold them to anyone. So as a result, you can't get them on iTunes or anything like that. You tried doing a Beatles demo?
No.
Someone could correct us, I'm sure. I just thought that was a good gossip story. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. We do tend to waffle this time of the night, but we're going to go away and come back with all the good things that we know, the website, gadget, and odd spot. We've sort of had one in reverse
another
there.
Another odd spot.
Another odd spot of the week.
For listening. Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! Oh, this thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Out of my own!
This week's gadget is Sony's new Walkman, NW-EO13F. What is an EO13F, I hear you ask?
Yes, what's an EO13F?
Well, Australia's gadget magazine T3 recently reviewed 5 mini MP3 players. Now, Graham, you need a new MP3. Well, you need a MP3 player, don't you?
Yeah.
And you need an MP3 player.
Yes.
It's testing.
Stick with us, kid.
Yes. Coming up,
I've thrown you, haven't I?
Dr. Ron's discourse on the indefinite article. The five that were reviewed were we had an Creative Zen Stone. We had an iPod. Graham's hitting me. Stop hitting me. An iPod Shuffle, the Mobi Blue Cube 2, the iRiver T60, and a Sony Walkman NW-EO13F. The winner was the Sony Walkman.
Really? The Sony one?
Good on your Sony.
What's so good about it?
Audio quality, the bright three-line colour LCD.
It was voted by females, was it?
Album art. and the monstrous 30-hour battery life.
Oh, there you go. That's battery life's important. Bad. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's good.
The only thing the bad thing they said was getting music on it is a pain thanks to Sonic Stage. Where have I heard that before?
I'm very familiar with Sonic Stage.
Which I think we all are, aren't we?
Yeah.
But they gave it 5 stars. It's not currently available in Australia, but it's selling online for about 47 UK pounds, which is a bit over $100.
Okay.
Well done. Okay. So what was it called again?
It's Sony's Walkman, the NWEO13F.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
The website of the week on Tech Talk Radio is a strange one. It's a bit of a novelty thing, but I like the user interface, so I thought I'd throw it in for you to have a look at. It's called the Real Age Calculator.
Yes.
The address is www. Now, let me put my teeth in. Poodwaddle.
What?
I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to pronounce that. poodwaddle.com /realage.htm, but we'll put links to it on the website and in the forum. Your health and lifestyle and personal habits have a dramatic effect on your lifespan, apparently.
It asked me a lot of very rude questions when I tried it out last night.
What did it ask you, Graham?
Oh, all sorts of things. Asked me whether I, how much exercise I did and...
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff.
Google's
and
got problems.
Whether I ate properly or all that sort of stuff.
All that stuff. It starts out by asking you your real age.
Yeah.
And then it asks you a series of questions, as Graham said, about 34 questions about your lifestyle. And then it calculates your actual health age.
Yes.
So it told me that despite having a real age of 30 something, it said my health age is actually 25.
Does it take your career into consideration?
It does take your career into
consideration. It told me I was 97 and should have died last week.
Oh, okay. That's no good. And it told me my life expectancy was 83.7.
You're doing a lot better than me.
So it said you were 83.7 and you should have yeah, shuffled off already.
Something like that, yeah.
Oh, have a look at the real age.
What's the URL again? Can we go there? Poodwaddle?
Yes, www.poodwaddle.com/realage.htm.
There is a fine line between genius and madness. Shoot.
Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Andrew, how many free 3 to 3 minutes do you get a month?
300.
300 free 3 to 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's for people listening overseas. That's free calls we get on our mobiles.
So a short phone call is a good phone call?
Always.
A British man has broken the world record for the longest phone conversation. Tony Wright, 42.
Hang on a minute. Sorry, there's an error in this article. I've spotted it already. You said it was a man?
It was a man.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh, Graham. Tony Wright, 42, from Penzance in Cornwall, enlisted public help in the record-breaking attempt by appealing to shoppers at the Tesco Kensington Superstore in London and getting people to submit conversation suggestions on his website, longestinternetphonecall.com.
He's just asking for it, isn't he?
He is. His record bid started by chatting to a TV weather forecaster at the start of last week, then hundreds of people undertook hourly chat slots with Mr. Wright to help him beat the record. 40 hours later, the record was broken. The world record attempt celebrates the launch of a new low-cost monthly call plan from Tesco Internet Phone and helped raise money for the British Red Cross.
Fantastic.
Very good.
A 40-hour phone call.
It's like a my wife could do that. I'm sure your mother could do it too, just quietly.
You'd run out, you'd use up all your free 3 to 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah, you would. That's why you use the internet.
That's why he's done it with the Tesco service.
Yes. All right. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron Graham Callaghan and myself, Andrew McComb. Next week, Justin Dunlop is coming into the studio to talk about Macintoshes. Good to have someone who knows what they're talking about in here rather than us three prattle on about Macs and things like that. So that'll be very interesting.
He might bring his apple orchard with him.
He might. I hope he doesn't. No, there's no room for it in the studio.
Exactly. All right. Jeff in the United States uses our show as breakfast radio, and true to form, he has been listening this morning over his Wheaties.
Morning, Jeff.
Morning, Jeff. His DVR is not a TiVo, but it allows fast forward and skipping at 30-second intervals.
Oh.
All he has to do is has to press the fast forward button 4 times and it skips the 2-minute commercial break. So there you go. That's from a user in the US. So well done, Graham. You put out, you ask and you shall
receive? Yeah. Or was it Ron who asked that question? But anyway, so stay with us for next week. Be sure to tune in, same time, same station, regardless of where you're listening around the countryside. We love having your company. Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au. Have I missed anything, boys? Oh, the one. Let's talk about the 1300 number like Jonathan Ooh. Did tonight. 1-300-664-882. If you have a gripe about anything or would like to send bouquets or anything, we'll put them to air. Just ring our 1300 number and leave a message and we'll get back. We'll play it on air.
If you can't ring 1300 numbers or you're listening overseas, plus 613-901-253-62.
Yeah, indeed. All right, until next week, it's bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications and podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM, Highlands FM and Queer FM in Western Australia. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.